BSing with
who?
BSing with
what?
BSing with Sean K. BSing with
who?
BSing with
what?
BSing with Sean K. BSing with
who?
BSing with
what?
BSing with Sean K.
Hello. Welcome to BSing with Sean K on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Sean Neese, and on this show, I BS with people who live outside the box and provide a platform for opinions not often heard in the mainstream media. And in this episode, I'm going to play you a conversation I had with Frank Lobuono. He's a journalist, photographer, and writer. And Frank has been involved in the television news and production business for over 30 years. His work has brought him many places around the country and world, where he has covered some of the most important events of the 21st century. Frank also presents his original writing and photography on his personal blog, Talk Frank, Medium, and his photo website, Sojourner Photography. He lives in Nyack, New York, and is currently employed by CBS News in New York. He is also an adjunct lecturer at Fordham University in the Bronx, New York, and Lincoln Center, Manhattan. And he was my professor at Fordham, and also my advisor for my final thesis project while I was going for my master's in public media and journalism at Fordham. One of the first things I did for his class was a photography project where I went out and I took candid photos with my phone, and I still have some of those photos I took. I really like this one photo I took of this man on the street who had these birds and other animals with him, and like there were birds like all over his shoulder. I think it was like I believe he was like selling animals that could be pets, like outside. And I took a picture of him, and I ended up using that for the cover of the demo I'm working on for my music project Insomniac AD, and I just put like a black and white filter on it. I also like this other picture I took when I was in this class of everybody on the subway, but they were listening to their headphones or not looking at each other, and I wrote under it, "We all live in our own little worlds." And I just thought that was a good that was a good representation in that photo of like how we've become more disconnected in some ways, even though we're all right by each other. We aren't even looking at each other. Some of the earlier episodes of this show I worked on while I was taking his class, and I also used them as projects for his class, and he really got me to challenge myself more with my work. And I definitely think that I've improved a lot of my craft through learning what he taught me. And now, you know, I'm taking more steps with the show. I'm a part of this network now. And I found his story inspiring. And I think other people trying to make it in the broadcast or media entertainment will find it inspiring as well. And here it is. And I hope you enjoy it. I'm here with Frank Lobuono.
Lobuono.
Yes, it's actually a Sicilian derivative, and people have difficulty with it because of there's a U in it. It's L O capital B U O N O, and people get familiarized with Bono from U2, of course,
yeah.
And Sonny Bono. So that's in their heads, and they forget there's a U in there. And Sicilian, like the Italian language, every syllable is pronounced. So it's Lobuono.
Yeah, we're not used to that as much here in America.
Generally speaking, really. Yeah, well, because we have a tendency to anglicize everything.
Yeah.
Because it is an Anglo, we speak English, which is an Anglo culture, so sometimes names that have a little more ethnicity to them, not only Italian, but French, and Taiwanese, etc., can prove difficult because it's a completely different pronunciation key. Although Italian is pretty simple because everything is said exactly the way it's spelled if you stay within the pronunciation key. So it's Lobuono.
Yeah, that's true. We don't always say everything the way it's spelled. Right. It looks different than it sounds.
And especially in New York, we speak so fast. That's a big, you know, we've heard of the legendary New York minute, which is a few seconds. So we tend to shorten things as well. And even what's interesting, and there's been a number of articles, even how Italian has become bastardized within our culture too. For example, gabagool for capicola. You know, you hear it on The Sopranos, for example. Calamad for calamari. If you spoke the way we often speak Italian, if you will, in the metropolitan New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, if you did that in Italian, they'd start laughing at you, or they wouldn't understand you at all because it's so different. But there are reasons for that, too, because so much Italian and dialect came from so many different places. It's kind of an amalgamation of a number of different dialects plus a little English thrown in. So, but that's what the beauty of America is, when you let it be, is to have that true mixing pot, and where every culture contributes on some level, even in language. The Irish, for example, are a million literally Irish words, not only Irish-American, Gaelic-Irish words that have come into our culture as quote-unquote normal English words, which really have a different root.
Yeah, and so it kind of combines into one. American culture is kind of a mix of different cultures altogether.
It is. It's why it's difficult sometimes to say I'm an American. American is a lot of things, and that's we're changing somewhat. And unfortunately, that's a conversation for another day.
Yeah.
Not necessarily for the better. But the whole idea was that we are strong because we are diverse.
Yeah, so different people coming together to make it.
Absolutely, and everybody contributes. Everybody, Slovaks, Asians, Irish, Italians, and they've all passed through a period of difficulty where they weren't necessarily received in the best light possible. But through persistence and honesty and integrity, they've won a part of America, and that's really what it is. It's an amalgamation, and always should be.
Yeah, and I guess we'll get into you and like what you do. You're a journalist here at CBS,
right?
Mm-hmm. And you also do writing. You have a blog.
I do.
And you were my professor at Fordham.
Correct, for your graduate class, which I love. I love teaching at Fordham. I love it as a university. One of the things that surprised me was how diverse we did. We talked a little bit about diversity. Fordham is known as the Catholic University of New York, and it is. It's a Jesuit school. But I was really impressed by the diversity in the faculty. So many Jewish professors, for example. You think in a Catholic school, and you know, making the quotation mark things. But even some of the students, we had many openly gay students, a few transgender students that lived openly within the campus, and I was very impressed by that, and that they were encouraged to live, from what I saw anyway, openly and freely. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. So that's what do you enjoy about teaching?
I do, and I like the connection with the students. You're a student. You were a student in my class. You could probably tell me otherwise. But you know, my one of the first things I say to my students is forget grades, because this is not, and it should never be about grades. It should be about learning. You know, and I've had a 35-year career. I've traveled around the world and on stories, and I have kind of a unique story where I came from the ground up, if you will, to build a career, and I like to share that with young people and say that if you apply yourself and you get the opportunity, you go for it and you make a go of it.
Yeah, let's start at the beginning of like how you.
Well, you'll find it interesting, and maybe your listeners will as well. Even though I'm a journalist now, my degree is in microbiology and I even went to graduate school for one semester in microbiology. I work with electron microscopes, so it was somewhat technical, if you will, at the same time. My idea was to go to medical school, and it's one of the reasons why I studied biology and microbiology, and I thought maybe a PhD, MD path for me might work. But I was living much more my father's dream, if you will, for what I should become instead of my own. My father was a classic child of the Depression. He lost his father when he was very young. Then World War II broke out, and that interrupted his education. So you had a man who loved learning, who didn't didn't have the opportunity to express that love for learning, at least as a young man. Later on, I was very proud of him, in his 50s, he actually went back to Bergen Community College in New Jersey and earned an associate's degree, which he was very proud of. But as part of his work, he became a Bergen County Sheriff's Officer, and one of his assignments was as a court attendant. So he used to have to attend and guard, if you will, these big trials, where he watched lawyers and doctors testify, often in very important, literally life and death cases. And he became so impressed with their knowledge and their presentation of knowledge, he said, Frankie, these men are literally, they're through the strength of their learning and knowledge, have the power, if you will, over life and death. That's something very attractive. That's something you should think about. I was good in school. I always got pretty good grades. So he thought my application would be to either become a lawyer or a doctor, like the people that he saw who had the ability through their learning to change the world. And he always encouraged me in that way. But my heart was never entirely in it. Even though I like the sciences and I love the idea of helping and medicine and biology, I enjoyed, but it really wasn't necessarily a passion. And I remember, and this is how different decisions are made in your life that can affect you. I think I was a sophomore in school and I went to Rutgers in New Jersey and at the Newark campus. And my English comp teacher, in a conference with me, asked me about my major, and I said I was a science major, pre-med, etc. And she almost begged me to minor, at least, in English, because she said, Frank, you write so well. You know, I know you really want to do this biology thing, but you should certainly consider developing your writing a little bit more, because you the kernel is there for something. And I never forgot that, so even through all my work in the sciences, etc., I always kept writing. Then many years later, I was really I was earning a living, but I was really kind of struggling, if you will. I was living on my own in an apartment with a roommate, and I was driving a taxi. Good money, easy work. It allowed me to experiment, if you will, with other writing and things that I was into, and yet still earn a living enough to be able to pay for my rent, etc. But I was really just spinning my wheels. Here I am, I had a degree from a major Northeastern University, Rutgers, graduate credits, etc., and I'm driving a taxi. Well, one day, my father came to the taxi stand. He often would come by. He was retired at the time, and he really loved our company, one of the nice things about it. So if he was in the neighborhood, he would drive by the taxi stand, and if I was there, he would stop by and we'd chat for a while. Sometimes he'd get me a sandwich or something. Well, one day he brought me a piece of paper, and on it was a phone number for NBS Radio, the National Broadcasting System. Okay, not NBC, NBS, that had a set of studios on 32nd Street near Madison Square Garden in the city, and they were looking for amateur announcers, and they were going to hold an open audition on this particular day. All you had to do was call and find out more information, and you could go for the audition. Well, this was kind of a big breakthrough for me, because now my father, in a sense, gave me approval to do more things that I was interested in doing, and I was, obviously, I'm talking like crazy. I'm interested in communication. So he said, why don't you try these? He said, you know, I know you're struggling, but you can talk, so why don't you try making a living with it? And he gave me this phone number. I followed up with it, and I had never experienced what a voiceover was like. And they put me in a sound booth, a glass booth, with people outside staring at me with a microphone in front, and they gave me some of the worst copy you can imagine to read. It was a PSA for colon cancer. So how do you make a copy like that come alive? And of course, I didn't really have any skill within it, but I did my best, and I found out that I quote-unquote passed the audition. What I found out afterwards, that about 400 other people passed the audition at the same time. It was a school, in a sense, and it had some legitimacy to it, but it also had a little bit of a sidebar, if you will, where they would make money. Once you got accepted into the program, what they did is they trained you on the sound equipment to be able to record your radio show for 15 minutes. And it was really nice, because they gave you creative carte blanche so that I could do little thematic radio shows. And then what they would do, they would air them on their affiliate. They had a network of affiliate stations throughout the country, and they would use these little 15-minute radio shows to fill their lineup on their radio stations. And they would charge you a nominal fee for a half hour in the studio. It wasn't much, $25 or $50. So they were getting paid, if you will. But in return, you were getting some experience. Well, in a thing of good fortune, one of the so-called program managers, a woman named Linda, who had a lot of major market radio experience in California and in New York, and particularly on a couple of Long Island radio stations, pulled me aside. And this is where, in your life, mentors can help you, and you should listen to them. She pulled me aside. She said, Frank, I could get fired for telling you this. She said, but the school is really kind of a scam, if you will, okay? Because they've accepted so many people. And out of all of those people, literally the hundreds of people in the program, there's probably only about two or three that will make it in the broadcasting industry, and I think you have the skills to be one of those. So she helped me to put together a demo reel and schedule some appointments, some job interviews, if you will, with radio stations around the New York area, especially smaller ones. Obviously, I didn't have the experience for a big major market radio like WCBS or WABC, which you hear here. But anyway, one of the interviews took me to a place in New Jersey, WDHA, which was called the Jersey Giant in the time. This was in the early 80s. Terrific progressive rock and roll station.
Yeah, it's still there. It's right in
Morristown or Dover. It's out in that
area. Right near where I live.
Oh, interesting. Those days, it was very progressive, okay, where, you know, most radio in New York was top 40, most of it. And WDHA was much more progressive, played things like the Ramones and people of that nature, which you wouldn't hear on major market radio. So she thought I'd be a good fix there. And I went, and the program manager at the time was a fellow by the name of Mark Chernoff. Now, it might be a familiar name to some of your friends and listeners, because he became the program manager for the Howard Stern show. And he was often parodied and made fun of, as Stern would do on most of his stuff. But he, from there, he also parlayed his career into big-time stuff with Howard Stern. Well, he conducted the interview, and we went to the same high school, Fort Lee High School in New Jersey. He was a bit older. He was my older sister's age, but I remember him, and he remembered me, and I went to school. His sister was also a little bit younger than me, so we had that connection. And he remembered me as a high school and college athlete. I played football and baseball in high school and went on to play some college football. And he liked my tape. He said, obviously, you have talent. You're a little, you know, I don't think you're necessarily ready for us yet, this quite a radio station quite this size. He said, but why don't you parlay your athletic career into some level of broadcasting? What about sports casting? Which I hadn't really even considered. I was an athlete and I was interested in sports, but I wanted to do things on a broader sense. He said, but that will get your foot in the door. So I started shipping my little tape out to some of the cable stations, but it was an audio tape, and most of them would say, to backtrack a little bit, he said, look, a lot of these small cable stations are now starting programming departments, particularly with sports, to cover local high school sports, local high school football games, basketball games, baseball, etc. Why don't you explore getting in on that way? So I did. I sent out the tape to a few of the local cable companies, a nibble here or there, but nothing firm. Well, driving the cab one day, and this is sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, I ran into another high school friend, someone who I had played high school football with, and I picked him up, and we started gabbing, and he said, hey, Frank, it's a long time. What are you up to? And I explained. I said, well, I'm driving right now, but I'm looking to try to get into some kind of broadcasting. And he said, dummy, didn't you know I'm the general manager of a small cable station in Westchester, in Harrison, New York? Why don't you come over and do some football games for me, and we'll take it from there, and we'll go. So I started doing high school football games on Saturday afternoon with a single VHS camera with a lavalier mic clipped to my lapel, and I announced the games while I shot the games, and that's how I started. But after a while, I did a number of games, and we were going to go into the basketball season, and I said to my friend, I said, look, I don't mind doing it for nothing, but now it's actually costing me money because I have to gas and tolls and things of that nature. I'd rather not have it cost me money if at all possible. Well, another stroke of good fortune, he moved to a slightly larger cable company called TKR Cable in West Nyack, New York, that gave him a little bit more of a budget, and he said, I'll make a deal with you. I'll pay you $25 a game to do those over here, so at least you can pay for your gas and tolls. And that was a big break for me. So now, instead of questioning, and everybody has to make that decision in their careers, how much are you willing to sacrifice to get what you want? And at that point, the fact that he made just that little gesture to meet me at least part ways, I never questioned another assignment after that. So instead of saying, when he said, look, I need you to jump, and I'd say, well, I don't know if I want to jump, I said, how high? So from that point on, eventually a part-time position within the cable production house came open for a production assistant. I applied and I got the job, and I was making $5.40 an hour. This was in the early 1980s, but I got an enormous amount of experience there. I was lucky through him, he was the general manager, and a couple of other general managers who were very supportive of our creative efforts to try to create local programming, programs of interest. We did magazine shows, political talk shows, shows for health information, for legal information. We created a really nice little local programming department, and I kept working my way up through the ranks from a production assistant, then I became a producer, then I became a senior producer, and then I became program manager for what has now become Cablevision. And a lot of the things that I had proposed over 30 years ago have come now to fruition at Cablevision, including News 12, Varsity Sports that they show. All of that we kind of pioneered at this little cable station in West Nyack, New York. At one point, after about 15 years, I got called into the boss's office, the vice president, and when I walked in, I saw the human resources person was there, and that's never a good sign. And this is literally the quote he gave me. He said, you're the best production person I know, but I don't know what to do with you, so I'm going to let you go. And they basically, quote unquote, fired me. It sounds like a harsh term, but they... You can't necessarily say that because they made me a wonderful severance package, a year and a half of severance salary, etc. But now here I am. I've built this career, and I'm out there, kind of freelancing. So I decided to start my own production company, Sojourner Productions, which I still have, where I would do photography and video for hire, and was doing that for a while. And then 9/11 happened. And the day of 9/11, actually the day after 9/11, I had a contact here at CBS. One of the directors for the evening news, a fellow by the name of Steve Bessner, had been in contact with me for years when I was at Cablevision. And he was always very supportive. He would call and say, look, I watch your stuff and I know you have talent. I could see it. Don't quit. Keep going. And someday you'll catch your break. Well, I called him and said, you must need all the help you can get. This was 9/11. You know, I can do camera. I even have my own camera quality, professional camera that I was using for my independent production work. I'm available if you need me. And he said, how quickly can you get here? So my first assignment for CBS was 9/11. And I was on the rooftop of a building 40 stories up in the corner of, on the corner of Greenwich and Worth Streets, with a long lens shooting down into Ground Zero, into the pit, if you will, looking for all different activity, rescues, etc. Pulling one of the shots I got, which I'll never forget, which I see from time to time and it still gives me chills, was pulling this huge hook and ladder engine out of the rubble with this big crane and just seeing how flattened and totally destroyed it was. So I spent 8 or 9 days down at 9/11 covering night and day on a 12-hour on, 12-hour off shift for 9/11. That was my first entry into CBS. Then from there, little by little, I got more and more freelance work, and now I've been there since, you know, since 2001, so it's been 19 years here at CBS, and I've had a great career. I'm winding down. I'll be 65 in April, and I've had a long career, a very rewarding career. I got to do things and see things I would have never seen before. I covered Hurricane Katrina in addition to 9/11. I did Hurricane Sandy. But I also got some cushy assignments. Like, I got to do the royal wedding in London and spent 2 weeks there. I got another incredible experience. I got to cover the election of Pope Francis the First. I was in Rome for 30 days for that. I've seen a space shuttle launch as close as they will allow any civilian to get to it, which was an incredible experience. I saw a nighttime shuttle landing. I've done virtually all of the political conventions since 2001. I saw the election of our first black president. I've done inaugurations. So I've had I've managed to parlay it into a great career and even managed to make a decent amount of money, which is not a terrible thing, Sean. It's okay to be paid for your services and at times be well paid. But I've had, as I said, a good career all told, over 30 years, made a lot of friends, again, seen many things that ordinarily you just wouldn't have. I certainly wouldn't have, and most people haven't. So I've been, you know, grateful to have had the opportunity to do that. And now I continue. I'll never stop work. I'll continue to teach because I love to teach. I have a blog, Talk Frank. Forgive the trite name. I wanted Frank Talk, but that was already taken, so I had to settle for Talk Frank. And I will. And one of the things I encourage my students, I'll write about anything. I've written about my car. You know, that it's it's a reflection of who you are, what you drive, and how many miles it has on it, and stuff like that. I do get political from time to time. I think, and I separate my journalism, if you will, from my punditry, which is a whole different thing, and use disclaimers and explain. And I think you can do both. When I'm doing camera, if I don't like the candidate, it doesn't affect my ability to shoot him and show exactly what's happening at that moment. But then afterwards, if I have an opinion about what happened there, I'm more than glad to show it. I also have a photography blog, Sojourner Photography, and I use the word sojourner, by the way, means to take a trip, but to also to not just travel through. It means to stop, take some time, learn, see, feel while you're doing it. And I wanted to use that word to convey that in my photography and my video. Stay for a bit, look at it, share it, share your thoughts with it. So that's where the name Sojourner came from. So I have Sojourner Photography, and one of the things, as you well know, that I've taught, I make virtually all of my photos on a cell phone because it's always with you. Yes, I have better cameras and sometimes use them, but I don't lug them everywhere with me. The cell phone is everywhere, and I encourage students and people who are interested to be in the moment, to have it, and because you have it, to use it. Now, I started in the old film days, too. I sound like an old man, but it's the truth. And film was unwieldy, if you will, and expensive. You know, you had to buy the film. Then you had to pay to develop the film. And if you took 36 exposures, maybe I liked one or two out of the 36. So sometimes it would limit the amount of photographs you would make. Now, with digital photography and cell phones, okay, I could take 1,000. Who cares? I'll throw away 999 of them to get the one that I like, and it doesn't cost me anything.
And you don't think like the quality of like a phone photo is about just as good as like.
And it is, generally speaking, unless you're really going to do super professional photography and enlarge it beyond 12x14 or 16x20, then you really want a really expert. But for everyday use, the more important thing is to make the photo. And by the way, I always say make a photo. I got that. One of my mentors was a Pulitzer Prize winner by the name of Nat Fine, who took the very famous photo of Babe Ruth at the retirement of his numbers when he's kind of leaning on his bat looking out into Yankee Stadium. I learned a lot from Nat, and he, you know, his whole thing was make the photo. And he always said, make the photo, because he created photos. You know, they were extensions of himself. And one of the, another thing that I learned from him was, you know, you ask Nat, what makes for a great photograph? And he thought for a quick second, and he said, tell you honest truth, and he was a very plain speaker, for a New York City kid, and he said, Frank, I could give a shit for a technically perfect photo that had no soul. So it's all about the soul.
Like capturing the moment.
Absolutely, capturing that moment, and as you see it, okay? And that's the most important thing. And if you don't like it, you don't have to share it. But sometimes you get lucky, you know? But you, again, all these hackneyed phrases, but it's the truth. You have to be in it to win it. If you're not making the photos, well, then you got nothing. It's almost like what people, not to get overly political, but it's what people talk about voting. Well, I don't vote. Well, then it's worthless. If you don't use it, it's worthless. Then it is worthless. Same thing with your photos. If you're not making the photos, well, then you got nothing. Yeah, and you never know. A few weeks ago on Veterans Day, as a matter of fact, I got what I think, and I've been complimented on it, is an extraordinary photo of the George Washington Bridge. And this is where luck comes in, but also some knowledge of why you might be taking the photo. Let me explain. I'm coming up the West Side Highway, leaving CBS to go to my place in Nyack, and I'm going to go over the George Washington Bridge. And I noticed it was still lit, that bright light, white lights that they do for special occasions, and it was Veterans Day. So I said, gee, I might be able to get a few decent photos out of this, and I know that as you come off the West Side Highway, there's a long, winding ramp, but as you come up the ramp, you get a nice perspective of the towers and the bridge. So I put my phone in the hands-free unit, set up the camera, ready to go. Of course, I'm not going to hold the camera. I don't encourage that in anybody. It was hands-free. Okay. And as I got up through this rise onto the bridge, I just kept hitting the shutter, hoping, again, but yet also knowing that if I hit it right, I might get something special out of it. And sure enough, one of the most remarkable things about the photograph is that there's no traffic. And that never happens on the George Washington Bridge. I was hoping that maybe if I didn't get behind a truck because there's so much tractor-trailer traffic on the upper level of the bridge. Well, if you see the photo, I just happened to time it where there's only actually one car coming in the opposite direction and virtually nobody going over the bridge in the same direction. So it looks almost abandoned with the two towers lit. And so it was a combination of being lucky, okay, but also knowing that if I did get lucky, I might get something out of it. And that's what I encourage with everybody. You know, you just might get lucky. Just make the photo. You know, take the shot, as they say. And I think that's an important thing. And I think digital technology has made it so much more accessible for all of us to do more artistic endeavors.
Like more candid photos?
And I even get in trouble with that. I love to do street photography. People are always attacking me.
There's no law against like taking a picture of someone
on the street. People have to understand it. Yeah. You are protected, and I teach that in the class. You are protected by the First Amendment. Now, I'm not a bastard, and if somebody can give me a compelling reason why not to use the photo...
I mean, obviously, I guess I wouldn't go up to random people on the subway and just start taking
pictures. You could actually even do that. I'll give a quick story. In my town, I live up in Nyack, and it was a rainy gray day, and I saw a woman and her young daughter walking together on this really gray and rainy day, and they had matching very colorful raincoats, rain boots, and umbrellas. And it was just this splash of color on a gray day, and that's all I saw in the photo. So I published it. I put it out on Facebook as part of my portfolio, and the woman took exception to it, that she didn't give me permission to use the photo. And I try to explain to her that I didn't need her permission to use the photo. And it started this, oh man, people attacked me, and you know, why are you being such a bastard and such a hard ass, and etc. The point was, is because I wanted to protect my rights as a photographer, my First Amendment right, which is freedom of expression. And no matter what anybody said, the Supreme Court has ruled over and over again that your right for freedom of expression trumps your right to privacy when you're in a public space. Now and again, and I try to explain, what was happening, Sean, was that people were bullying me or trying to bully me into taking off the photograph, and that will never happen. I will never be bullied into lessening my art for less than a good reason, if you will. Okay, and that's what I wanted people to understand. If you give me a compelling reason, like maybe you're in the witness protection program, that's a good reason to pull the photo. Seriously, if the woman was a victim of abuse and was trying to protect her privacy and the daughter's privacy, and you told me that, which eventually somebody did, and so I took down the photo. But until that point, telling me you don't like it and you haven't given me your permission ain't good enough. That's no reason to compel me to stop making my photographs. And I have a right to make them, and you do, and all your listeners do. It's the same even with the police. Now, remember, I was this New York beat photographer for CBS for years, and I had to deal with the police, and I'll tell you now, more times than not, they were cooperative than not cooperative. It's got to be fair here, okay? But you have to understand that they have a job to do, you have to have a job to do, and there's a reasonable compromise within that, okay? You can't get in the way of their work, but short of that, I'm making this shot.
And that if there's any foul play, then you're able to look. There's video evidence.
Sure, and that's one of the reasons also that the Supreme Court supports freedom of expression, all right? And it's an example. You're in a local town, and you're walking by, and the mayor of the town comes out, and he's inebriated, and he's sloppy and falling all over the place, and you make a photo of that for the news, and you give it to the newspaper the next day, of course he's going to be pissed off. He doesn't want to be seen that way, but he was. He was that way. He was seen that way. So you should not be able to be intimidated into not publishing that photo.
Or I was thinking, like, if there's a suspect, like America's Most Wanted kind of thing, and you see if someone who looks like that, and you take a picture, like, oh, I think I saw him here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there are times where it can be used in evidence. There are legal issues with it, but from a creative standpoint, and you have to understand, if you go out in the street, you're going to hear that from time to time. People have to be prepared for that. Now, I know even your show, you try to interview people who are not in the mainstream. Well, if you're not going to be in the mainstream, you need to be prepared to suffer the slings and arrows.
Backlash to, like, what you say. If
absolutely, of course, of course. Same, but you show, and I say lots of controversial shit on my blog. I do all the time. I'm not afraid of it, but I also try to. I always avoid pejoratives and ad hominem attacks, if you will, personal attacks. I don't want to call anybody an idiot or moron. I certainly try to avoid that. And everybody gets hot once in a while. Somebody pushes the right buttons, and you're ready to meet violence with violence, if you will. But you really have to try to avoid that. But also at the same time, be firm. I said, I'm not going to retract that, especially if you believe in it and you can support it. Remember, that's another thing. And there's so much disinformation out there. It's incredible. He was a classic. And if you read my blog, I'm not a big supporter of the current administration. That's an understatement, but that's a story again for another day. but even within that, there has to be truth in all of it. The point I'm trying to make, there was an internet meme with a picture of Donald Trump, the president, with his mother, and the slogan that his mother said, that even as a kid he was an idiot and a moron. And you know, I looked at it and I said, this doesn't smell right to me. Nobody's mother is going to publicly come out and call their child an idiot. So I did a quick search, and it's so easy now on the internet to search that stuff, and sure enough, it was disproven. There's no evidence whatsoever that his mother said that about Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's the same thing about how they said that he said that if he were to run, he'd run it as a Republican.
Correct.
Because people were too stupid. He never said that.
Correct. He never said that. And Sean, it's everybody's responsibility. Don't rely on Facebook to do it for you. I know people are pissed off. It's, oh, they're not.
Well, and like, if you're against someone and then you use something false to point out what, like, as a way to attack them or whatever, then that kind of just helps them.
Sure.
Because you're using something that's false. Like, find something real about Trump to attack. Like, I'm not a fan of Trump either, but, right. like, I'd want to attack him with something real.
Correct. And the point is, one of the things we attack him for is that he lies so much. So if you're lying just as much, well, then who's winning here? Okay? And part of the point that I want to make, Sean, is, and I was talking with one of my coworkers just earlier today, too, about how awesome the internet is for information. You can find out anything. We asked, matter of fact, I think it was, how old was Melania? And in a second, we said, well, let's find out. You go to Google, and within seconds we had our answer. So there's absolutely no reason to fall for false information. You can check everything, and you should always check your sources. And one of the truest sayings in ever, okay, if it's too good to be true, it usually is not true.
Well, I think it's also like people see the world a certain day, so they have kind of like a confirmation bias, and they're gonna look if something validates their worldview, they're not gonna want to double check it. They're gonna just agree.
And there's a term for that, cognitive dissonance. That's what cognitive dissonance is. Only finding things that support your particular point of view, often even if they're phony. Okay, but we as journalists, and you know, you're a journalist, this is what you have to avoid. You know, present your case, do it with honesty and integrity. And that's another important word that one of the first things I use in my classes with students. You have to have integrity. If you don't have that, you have nothing, absolutely nothing. You know, it's sometimes having integrity is even more important than being right, because you wanted to do the right thing. Everybody makes mistakes, and that allows for, you know, look, nobody's perfect. Even at times when I bash the press, look, people are allowed to make mistakes. He makes more than his share, but then we'll get that story for another day.
So, like, doing what's, I guess, doing what's right, even if, like, rather than just going against what you're, rather than trying to discredit someone in an unethical way, if you're against them, having integrity and being honest and being,
absolutely, because then that validates your point of view. You know, no one can question if my integrity is unquestioned. Well, people are going to listen to me. Yeah. Even sometimes they don't necessarily have to agree with me, and that's I even say that on my threads. And some of them, when they start going south, if you will, and starting getting nasty, I said, guys, look, I don't mind you arguing your point of view with passion, but keep it within the bounds of the discussion, and state your case, make your case, make your point of view, but do it with facts and not, you know, not insults. It's not necessary.
Yeah, and I also notice sometimes people will like take a clip of something someone said and then use that to discredit someone or like make someone look bad, but they're not looking at the full. They're not showing the full context of what that person.
And you
said.
You said the magic word, and you know that in our class, one of the things we talked about, context. You know, as an editor, and you do audio editing, you've done video editing, as I have. Okay, I can take anything out of context and put it with something else in a different context and completely change the meaning of an interview completely. So context is important. We spoke one of the things I like to do to demonstrate the difference in context is when people always say, I'm going to kill you. You say that about your little brother, you say that about your little sister, you know, oh man, I'm going to kill you, Bobby. Okay? There's a big difference between saying that and saying, I'm going to kill Bobby.
Yeah.
Okay? it's a different context. When you said it in a kidding sort of way, meaning to express just simple displeasure, there's another thing when you mean it in anger and to really cause bodily physical harm. There's a huge difference. So saying it the same words in different ways puts it in a different context. And context is everything. Everything.
So, like, did the interest in photography, did that come later than the writing, or was that...
Yes. Yeah, and very interesting. I took up photography much later in my career. I had a friend who had an interest in it, and he taught me how to develop the old film days. I had a little dark room where I could develop my own film, and that's when it started. But I actually got fairly late into the photography business, if you will, but certainly making up for lost time.
And I guess, what have you been writing about recently? I know the introspection was
I do that. I certainly the current administration gives me plenty of fodder for my writing. But also little things. Now, for example, and I'll think about them for a while. Sometimes I'll jot down the kernel of the idea and then go back to it. Just again, part of the introspective, I was thinking in the quiet of night sometimes, if you're a deep thinker, and I think about the state of the world and sometimes just how difficult it can be and how cruel the world can seem to be and how I often want to be able to do something about it, and it's frustrating to not be able to do enough. But then coming back to the idea that you don't have to save the whole world, you just have to save your small part of it. So that's the general kernel of idea, if you will, that's in my head right now. And what I'll do over the next few hours and stuff is start fleshing that out. And then I'll write a draft, and then I'll edit it numerous times before I actually publish it. But that's the general thought process. And I also, again, another thing that I try to teach my students is that it's mental exercise, and it's the same as physical exercise. You should do physical exercise all of the time, okay, whether you're into it or not, because it's a good habit to do so. And there are days, and I use the analogy of going to the gym. There are days you go to a gym, for those people who have experienced, where everything is going great. Your workouts are great. You feel good. You feel strong, and you're moving along. And there are other days it's drudgery. You know, like, why am I here? I don't want to be doing this. But you do it anyway because you want to keep the discipline of the endeavor. Writing is the same way, Sean. You should exercise your mind and exercise your writing. So there are days where I'm slogging through something, but I keep going because I don't want to lose the momentum, and I want to keep my mind sharp and pushing it sometimes past the point of exhaustion, if you will, opens your mind just as it does with your body. Sometimes when you can push that past that point of exhaustion, you really get into a good place. Now, of course, just like you don't want to tax your body to the point where you get sick, it's the same thing with your mind. If you need to take a break, take a break.
Yes, I guess you even wrote about, you wrote that one piece a while ago about that was showing that you can write about anything, right, but if you style it right, you can make it interesting.
Right, right. Yeah. And I always, you know, when I put so much of myself into my writing, and I encourage everybody to do that. Honest writing always connects. And I do get a fair amount of private comments. People do a private Facebook message, or sometimes comment directly on the blog. And the most complimentary is to say that, you know, you moved me. I hear you. What you say. And people say, you know, I may not always comment on your blogs, but they always have some meaning to me, and they're always so honest. If I can accomplish that, if anybody can accomplish that, you've done something. And I always write with honesty, always. You have to, and again, with integrity. And you may not agree with me. I got into a huge, huge fight a few weeks ago with discouraging people from using the name Fredo when they refer to Governor Cuomo, because I see it as an ethnic, if you will, slur. If you will, it's a new, more polite way, if you will, of calling somebody a dumb guinea. At least that's the way that I've seen it, and I express that point of view. Man, that I got absolutely attacked for that. Oh, you're a pussy, and you know, get tough, and you know, and there, it doesn't. Well, it does, and I was adamant about it, and I argued my point as to why I thought it was that way, and. But it can get ugly sometimes, and you have to be prepared, especially if you speak, you know, I was honest as I could be, how I felt about it. Now, again, if you disagreed, that's okay. And there were a few people that said, I think you're being overly sensitive. That's one thing. You know, other people calling me, you know, a pussy asshole, that's a whole nother thing. Once that happens, the conversation is basically over. You get nowhere with that. Nowhere.
Do you think it takes a while to develop that confidence to be able to handle that backlash, like putting something out there and dealing with, you know, people calling you this or that, or just having these angry reactions?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's you're not always entirely prepared for it. I think that I am sometimes, but it turns out it still shocks me at times, and it can hurt. It can, but you have to consider the source. Like I said, only my friends can truly insult me. Because you have to consider the source.
Yeah.
Okay, strangers and stuff who insult me with things of that nature, you know, that's nothing. That's, you know, but if my friends were to say stuff like that to me, then I would be hurt by it. But yes, it does take a little bit to, you know, just slough it off and shake it off and just move on and realize, well, that's their problem, not yours.
Yeah. And I almost feel like you have to reach that state to have, like, a real happiness. You have to reach that state where you're able to just be you and take the backlash. And
absolutely, yeah, sure.
If you just play it safe and you're polite all the time and you never, then that's not right, because you're holding something back. You're holding,
yeah. Right. You gotta shake, you gotta shake the stick once in a while, as they say. You shake the tree to get the acorns to come down. So, and I try to be, you know, and I make no bones about it. I try to be provocative, because when you're that way, that opens people up, and it should open the discussion, especially if you do it right. Like I said, not to allow it to be personal, but yet at the same time to argue your point with some vigor and with some being provocative. You know, if that opens your eyes and say, I can't believe he just said that, well, I just did. What are you going to say in return? That's where you start getting into that really back and forth interplay. That's really good stuff.
Is there any ways you've improved over the years, or ways you hope to improve more in the future with everything you do?
Oh, absolutely, no question. I'm working on my patience. I have, as a kid, I had a volcanic temper. I mean, you wouldn't be on. I could be very patient and friendly, but the classic saying, you know, it's a long fuse has a big stick of dynamite at the end, and I could have a volatile temper. And I've worked very hard through the years to control that temper. I have to continue to do so, and I'll see it. Every once in a while, as much as I say I don't want to get into the pejoratives and ad hominem and attacks, somebody's pushing the right button, and you just want to write back and say, well, you feel that way because you're an asshole, and leave it at that. And I'm trying to avoid that, because it doesn't really get you anywhere. Now, that doesn't mean you suffer fools endlessly. Like, yeah. At some point,
I guess if someone's really being an asshole,
yeah, exactly. I'm done with you. Thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah.
And I try not to block people for simple differences of opinion. But if it starts to get to the point where it's like, you know, this is just, I don't need you in my life. You're not rewarding me in any way that's fruitful. And that doesn't mean you have to be my best friend or call me the best guy in the world. It means that we've had a decent discussion. You've presented your point of view in an effective way. We may not agree, and that's okay. But it's the people that you can't reach that with. You just gotta write them off.
So, any final thoughts or things you'd like to say?
Well, I'm pleased that you asked me for an interview. I'm usually on that side of the microphone, so hopefully I didn't ramble too much for your guests and listeners. But it was a pleasure. I love what you're doing. I keep doing it. I have to say I'm pleased that I got this opportunity, and I hope I get more. I as you do, Sean. When you have something to say, say it. Find, there's no excuse with the tools that you have, sitting there with your iPhone and making photos with your cell phone camera and stuff. There's no reason now these days to not communicate well and not to express your artistic endeavors well. So just go out and do it. Keep doing it.
Yeah, if you have something to say and you really
say it.
Have to say it.
Say it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do Google Blogspot. It's free, Sean. They don't charge me anything. What a beautiful thing. You know, what I also have to say, with as much as I fear for the direction our country is going in terms of losing certain amounts of freedom and stuff, I'm still so pleased to say that you and I can sit and talk openly and freely, and you can broadcast discuss this. No one stops my blog. I say whatever I want on my blog. No one has tried to stop me at this point. Every once in a while I wind up in Facebook jail for saying something, but that's okay too. It's still a beautiful thing to be able to express yourself freely. Take advantage of it. Never use it. You have all the tools right at your fingertips to have a voice. Use your voice.
Yep. Only one life to...
Absolutely. That's if I could give anything to my students, and that's what I said, I see my mission is to help you guys discover your voice.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on and telling your story.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here, Sean. It really was. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to BSing with Sean Kay on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was a conversation, and I hope you enjoyed it. I definitely liked hearing Frank's story, and it was interesting all the different things he's covered, especially 9/11, like being there for the aftermath of that. And also the whole conversation about how sometimes there's a conflict between freedom of speech and the right to privacy when it comes to taking pictures in public or with journalism or getting the facts, you know, getting the story versus respecting someone's privacy. And also just the talk about journalism integrity in general and being ethical and being factual and presenting someone in a factual way, even if it's someone you disagree with or don't like, and not making up things to prove your point and being okay with seeing facts that don't fit your worldview. And also what he said about having thicker skin and speaking your mind regardless of the blowback you might have for speaking your mind. I'm definitely working on having thicker skin, and that's something that's very important when putting yourself out there in any kind of way with broadcasting or art or anything else. And before we wrap up, I have some important announcements to make for Radio Free Brooklyn. If you enjoy listening to Radio Free Brooklyn when you're not in front of your computer, download our mobile app, the Radio Free Brooklyn mobile app, and you can listen to it wherever, whenever. Also, please be sure to subscribe to our monthly newsletter for the latest news about new programming and upcoming Radio Free Brooklyn events. You can sign up at radiofreebrooklyn.org/newsletter. Now, lastly, I'm going to tell you about our Drive to Five fundraising. Radio Free Brooklyn's Drive to Five fundraising campaign is underway. In May, Radio Free Brooklyn turns 5 years old, and we need to raise $25,000. So we can continue bringing you BSing with Sean Kay and our other great programming for another 5 years. We're only about 30% there, so we have a long way to go in just a couple of months. If we're unable to reach our goal, it might be adios amigos to this show and dozens of others. If you'd like to make a small monthly donation to help us reach our goal, the easiest way to give is to text RFBGIVE5, the number 5, to 44321, and you can make a pledge right on your phone. We also have some great gifts for giving available on our website, including a limited edition 5-year t-shirts designed by former Clash manager Cosmo Vinyl. You might even be able to get a free one if you complete our monthly challenge. If you'd like to get one of these great premiums, you can make your donation at radiofreebrooklyn.org/drive-to-5. If you can't afford to give, you can still let us know how much you love us by calling our special voicemail at 718-673-8201. And leave us a message letting us know why you love Radio Free Brooklyn or to wish us a happy birthday. If you consent, your message may be played on the air. At Radio Free Brooklyn, we always welcome new neighbors. Dashi, a new American restaurant and cafe specializing in Japanese and Asian comfort foods, has just opened on 119 Ingram Street, only a few blocks from the Morgan L stop. They've got great dishes, noodles, rice dishes, small plates, and salads. And if you want a hamburger or BLT, they got that too. They're open every day, most days from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., and you can order online from Grubhub, Postmates, or DoorDash. Check them out at dashibrooklyn.com or stop by Dashi and welcome them to the hood. Tell them Radio Free Brooklyn sent you. Thank you for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Your support keeps us alive. And thank you for listening to BSing with Sean Kay on Radio Free Brooklyn. I will be back next week, and you can also listen to my episodes on Spotify and iTunes and on my website, seannice.com. And that about does it for tonight's episode. I'll catch you on the next one.